welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medical Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles, and today I'm going to talk about some of the news that came out of the European Heart Rhythm Association meeting, which was held April 23rd through the 25th, 2021, virtually, of course, this year. Unfortunately, we're still looking forward to the face-to-face meetings coming up soon next year. The Stroke Stop study looked at the benefits of systemic screening for atrial fibrillation. And patients with atrial fibrillation rate have a 5-fold increase of ischemic stroke, and a 10% of stroke patients have undetected atrial fibrillation also. So it leads to a 1.5 to 3-fold increase risk of death. The risk of stroke and death can be reduced by about 65% and 26% respectively when atrial fibrillation is diagnosed and patients receive treatment with oral anticoagulants. The Stroke Stop study aimed to evaluate whether early detection and treatment of atrial fibrillation can reduce the risk of ischemic stroke and death without an excess risk of bleeding. So the residents of two parts of Sweden who were aged 75 or 76 years old were identified and randomized into one of two groups, either a screening group or a control group, and there was absolutely no applicable exclusion criteria. And there were about 14,000 individuals in each of those groups. In the screening group, about 51.3% participated in the study, and they were followed up for a minimum of 5.6 years without any loss. Patient characteristics were well balanced between screening and control groups. However, there were significant differences between the participants and non-participants in screening, with subjects participating in the screening having significantly fewer comorbidities, and that was a significant value. The combined primary endpoint was ischemic stroke, systemic thromboembolism, all-cause mortality, and severe bleeding. Subjects without a history of atrial fibrillation who were invited for screening, that was about nearly 4,000 individuals, were examined via single-lead ECG twice a day for 14 days. Subjects in which atrial fibrillation was detected and patients with prior atrial fibrillation but without anticoagulant treatment were followed up systematically. Atrial fibrillation was significantly more often diagnosed in subjects participating in the screening than in controls, and that's a p-value of 0.0005. Final results from the primary endpoint showed a small but statistically significantly favorable outcome in the screening arm, with 4,456 incidences compared with 4,616 in the control arm. 91 invited individuals were required to prevent one event. Dr. Emma Svenberg from the Karolinska Institute in Sweden concluded that the population-based screening for atrial fibrillation provided a net clinical benefit in an elderly population. The presented study was one of the first to evaluate the benefits of systemic screening. Efforts must be made to increase participation in atrial fibrillation screening, as non-participants were at the highest risk of adverse events. Stroke Stop 2 will look further into potential socioeconomic factors influencing participation in screening examinations. In the RACE 3 trial, patients with early persistent atrial fibrillation and heart failure received either conventional plus targeted therapies or conventional therapies alone. While results were promising at the one-year point, results from the five-year extension study did not really show superior efficacy of the combined treatment. Targeted therapies aim to modify the atrial substrate and have a favorable effect on risk factors and diseases underlying atrial fibrillation. The RACE 3 trial had previously reported that targeted therapies, in addition to conventional therapies, improved sinus rhythm maintenance in patients with early persistent atrial fibrillation and mild to moderate early heart failure. This presentation was held by Dr. Michiel Rinstra from the University Medical Center in Groningen in the Netherlands and presented the five-year result from the RACE 3 extension study. This was a multicenter randomized trial, and it was aimed to evaluate whether the targeted therapy of underlying conditions could benefit the sinus rhythm maintenance by reducing cardiovascular risk. Participants with early atrial fibrillation and heart failure were randomly assigned to conventional therapies at just over 100 patients per group, 109 versus 107, or conventional plus targeted therapies. After 3 weeks, all patients were electrocardioconverted and received rhythm control and heart failure therapy according to guidelines. Patients in the targeted arm were followed up every 3 months for 5 years, and patients in the conventional arm received follow-up treatment every 3 months for 1 year and then once yearly. Patient characteristics were similar in both groups, and the mean age was 64 and 65, respectively, and 21% of the participants were women in both arms. The primary endpoint was sinus rhythm during 7-day Holter monitoring at 1 year. The presented outcomes were the long-term effects after 5 years of follow-up. So although, as previously reported, at 1 year the sinus rhythm was achieved by 75% of participants receiving targeted therapy versus 63% of participants receiving conventional therapy alone, with an objective response of 1.17, and that showed superior efficacy of the targeted therapy. But at 5 years, targeted therapy led to sinus rhythm in 46% of participants versus 39% of participants on conventional therapy, and that was no longer showed the significant difference in efficacy. So at 5 years, the rate of cardiovascular morbidity and mortality was similar between the treatment arms, with a log rank p-value of 0.35. Changes in the underlying conditions were statistically significant in systolic blood pressure, total cholesterol, and LDL cholesterol, with more favorable outcomes for the targeted treatment group. Professor Rinsta concluded that these long-term outcomes showed that targeted therapies on top of conventional studies did not improve maintenance of sinus rhythm in patients with persistent atrial fibrillation and heart failure at the 5-year follow-up. Dr. Nikola Pavlovich from a university hospital in Croatia presented the results on behalf of all investigators from the CryoFirst study, a randomized study to evaluate the effectiveness of cryoballoon ablation in first-line therapy as compared with antiarrhythmic drugs in patients with paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. Three studies on this topic were recently published, the CryoFirst, the STOP-AF-FIRST, and the EARLY-AF study. All three studies demonstrate that first-line cryoballoon ablation is superior to antiarrhythmic drugs for the prevention of atrial arrhythmia recurrence. However, the impact of first-line cryoballoon ablation on atrial fibrillation quality of life is less well characterized. The CryoFirst study enrolled 220 patients from 18 sites in 9 countries, and the participants were randomized 1-to-1 into pulmonary vein isolation of antiarrhythmic drugs treatment, class 1 or 3. The participants were monitored by 7-day Holter at 1, 3, 6, 9, and 12 months follow-up, and quality of life was assessed using 2 questionnaires at baseline and with cardiac monitoring. Results demonstrated no significant differences in the safety of the 2 treatments, and with a p-value of 0.28. Efficacy, defined as freedom from atrial fibrillation recurrence at 12 months, was significantly higher in the cryoballoon ablation-treated patients, 86.6%, than in the antiarrhythmic drug-treated patients, which was 75.5%, with a p-value of 0.02. Quality of life assessment reflected this outcome. Dr. Pavlovich, however, stated that quality of life assessments may have been impaired because the study was not blinded. In conclusion, the efficacy of cryoballoon ablation was superior to antiarrhythmic drug treatment in both presented endpoints, atrial fibrillation recurrence and quality of life. The safety profile of both treatment regimens was similar. Dr. Luca Segretti from the Azienda Ospedaliero Universitaria Pisana in Italy and co-workers aim to investigate the importance of timing of ablation in preventing atrial fibrillation recurrences. The CHARISMA registry included 153 consecutive patients undergoing atrial fibrillation ablation at 8 different Italian centers. Ablations were guided by a novel radiofrequency ablation catheter with local impedance and sensing capability through a dedicated algorithm. Patients were grouped as either early treated, and those were 80 of those patients, if that procedure was performed within the first year of the atrial fibrillation episode, or they were grouped as delayed treated, and there were 73 of those, if admitted for ablation after more than 1 year of the initial atrial fibrillation episode. The ablation endpoint was pulmonary vein isolation, as assessed by entrance and exit block. Post-ablation follow-up was scheduled at 3, 6, and 12 months. Atrial fibrillation and atrial tachycardia recurrences were considered as long-term endpoints. There were no significant differences in patient and arrhythmia characteristics between the groups. According to the current European Society of Cardiology atrial fibrillation guidelines, 80.4% or 123 individuals met the class 1 indications, 15% met the class 2A indications, and 7, so 4.6%, met the class 2B indications. The mean time to ablation procedure from the first arrhythmic episode was 202 plus or minus 113 days in early treated patients and 1,945 plus or minus 1,738 days in delayed treatment patients. No differences were found between the atrial fibrillation type in terms of ablation strategy. At the end of the procedures, all pulmonary veins had been successfully isolated in all study patients. So the mean follow-up period was 366 days, plus or minus 130 days, during which 18 patients, so 11.8%, suffered an atrial fibrillation recurrence after the 90-day blanking period. Recurrences occurred mostly in the delayed treatment group compared with the early treatment group, and that was a significant factor, a p-value of 0.04, or 17.8% versus 6.3%. And the time to atrial fibrillation recurrence was also longer in the early treated group, with a hazard ratio of 0.3, roughly. Multivariate logistic analysis adjusted for baseline confounders and showed that only hypertension was independently associated with recurrences, with a hazard ratio of 4.66. An early rhythm control therapy was associated with a low risk of recurrence beyond the hypertension risk factor, ranging from 2% at no hypertension and an early ablation therapy to 30.3% with hypertension and a delayed treatment procedure. Dr. Segrady concluded that patients with atrial fibrillation without common risk factors undergoing early ablation have a low risk of recurrence and that guided ablation of atrial fibrillation is safe and effective. The Effortless SICD registry evaluated the 5-year safety and efficacy of subcutaneous implantable cardioverter defibrillator. The objective of the Effortless SICD registry was to report the long-term outcomes of patients implanted with subcutaneous implantable cardioverter defibrillators. The focus of the presentation by Professor Pierre Lambiez of the University College London in the United Kingdom was on spontaneous efficacy through the 5-year study and predictors of later outcomes. A total of 984 patients with diverse underlying etiologies were enrolled in the study, of which 703 patients completed the study. Mean study follow-up was about 4.5 years. In only 20 out of 703 patients, 2%, SICD was replaced for a transvenous device for pacing. There were no definite electrode failures. Evaluation of late complications and inappropriate shocks showed that 1-year complications did not predict later complications. Inappropriate shocks were registered in 16.9% of the patients, with the main cause being cardiac oversensing. Patients were reprogrammed for causes of inappropriate shocks in year 1, had fewer inappropriate shocks in years 2 to 5, but this was not statistically significant. Patients were reprogrammed for causes of inappropriate shocks in year 1, had fewer inappropriate shocks in years 2 to 5. Cardiac inappropriate shocks were more likely to occur in years 2 to 5 due to low amplitude signaling and oversensing of the VT over VF. Evaluation of late appropriate shocks showed that 10% of patients had untreated episodes that were self-terminated, 6% had monomorphic VT, and 3% had a combination of monomorphic and polymorphic VT over VF, and 6% had VF alone. The main predictor for appropriate shocks was appropriate shock in the first year, with a p-value of 0.0001. Other significant predictors were prior cardiac arrest, heart failure, NYHA class 1 or 2, and ARVD. Importantly, ARVD and ischemic heart diseases were predictors for appropriate shocks for monomorphic VT, potentially identifying a special subpopulation. And shock efficacy was not significantly different between rhythm types. Of the 91 deaths reported, that was a total of 9.2%, none were associated with the SICD system or procedure. In summary, the results of the longest follow-up of SICD in a large cohort show that SICD maintains a high level of cardioversion efficacy over 5 years. Professor Lambiez also emphasized, quote, "Importantly, untreated inappropriate sensing episode did predict late inappropriate shocks, and this is an opportunity for reprogramming and personalizing therapy for these patients," end quote. Professor Jagmeet Singh from the Massachusetts General Hospital in the United States presented treatment strategies for patients not responding to cardiac resynchronization therapy, CRT. Response can be addressed using hard measurements, remodeling, soft clinical measurements, and composite scores. 43% of CRT patients are classified as non or negative responders after 6 months. However, responding is a continuum and a clear classification is often difficult, and approximately 30 to 40% of patients can be mild responders and non-responsive in some way. Determinants of CRT response include patient selection, lead implantation, device programming, and follow-up. For example, cardiac RT in heart failure with narrow QRS complex increased mortality, and considerable variability in electric activation sequence, as shown in endocardial maps, may explain the variability in CRT response and argue against the one-size-fits-all anatomical lead positioning strategy. Furthermore, non-responsiveness is often multifactorial, with some of the factors not being directly related to CRT, such as suboptimal medication or comorbidities. Individualized care using an integrated approach, including heart failure, cardiac arrhythmia, and echocardiography, led to a significant reduction of mortality. Optimization of the devices also showed better outcomes, sound standard programming, and use of automatic algorithms, such as adaptive CRT, smart CRT, respond CRT, or SyncAV. Lead location was also shown to contribute to clinical benefit, and apical left ventricular lead locations were associated with worse outcome, irrespective of QRS morphology and electrical activation sequence, while targeting the most electrically delayed areas improved clinical outcome. A study on multi-point pacing was recently stopped for futility, although multi-site pacing was shown to be effective in some cases. So Professor Singh summarized the importance of an individualized approach in CRT, and without the selection of the right procedure for the right individual at the right beginning, non-responsiveness is likely. To gain relevant clinical benefit, treatment of non-responsiveness must also follow an individualized approach, including medical optimization, resolution of rhythm issues, AV optimization, reassessment of lead location, and alternative pacing approaches. Thank you for listening to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. Stay safe and stay healthy. Thank you.